The Lean Out Podcast has covered lots of books in recent years. We have never covered a poetry book, but all it took was one read of a striking new collection of poems for me to know that I had to have its author on the show. The Canadian writer Stephen Marsh said it best when he described this collection. Like supremely eloquent graffiti written on the wall of a magnificent palace, except the palace is the world, and the world is on fire. Michael Lista is a Canadian essayist, journalist, and poet. His new book is Barfly and Other Poems. Michael Lista is my guest today on Lean Out. Michael, welcome to Lean Out.
It's a pleasure to be here.
As I've told you, I have never covered poetry before at Lean Out, but I found Barfly striking. And the voice is brash, defiant, a little roguish, a little nihilistic in places, undeniably masculine, and also exquisitely raw and vulnerable. And there's this bravado, but just beneath it, a kind of grief of being human and a kind of alienation. And I guess I wanted to start with this. I started my career as a hip-hop critic.
What? Oh my God, that's amazing. Oh my, you buried the lead before we were chatting. It's incredible. Okay.
Barfly sensibility really reminded me of some of the rap that I love the most. Now, obviously, this is not a sensibility we encounter very often in the Canadian literature community or even the Canadian poetry scene. To start today, talk to me about writing this volume of poetry and what you were feeling and thinking about and ruminating on as you were writing it.
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think there is a higher compliment than to say that it reminds you of some of the hip hop you covered, because, you know, I'm a huge hip hop fan. And I think my encounters with my love of it was something that was kind of unbidden, just creeping into my thinking about poetry for a while. So just to give you like a little bit of context of where Barfly sort of comes from. So it's my third book. I haven't published one in 10 years because I thought I was kind of done with poetry, to be honest. I'm happy to go into it, but I used to cover poetry and publish it as well as write it. So I think it's the only national poetry column in any Canadian newspaper for about 5 years, right? I didn't, you know, angle to get a job like that or anything. Mark Medley, who was running the National Post book section at the time, reached out to me and said, "Hey, do you want to have a column where you can essentially write unmolested about contemporary poetry however way you want?" And I was like, "Of course." But in doing so, I made the mistake that I think a lot of Canadian journalists make, which is sort of saying the quiet part out loud too frequently. And I kind of got run out of town and sort of pivoted to long form reporting, which I did for many years and continue to do. And then a few years ago, it was during the pandemic actually that it sort of started. I wasn't doing as much reporting because it was just so much harder to get access to sources in the way I wanted, to the courts. Everything had just sort of ground to a halt. And I was just sort of fiddling around one night with this voice that was kind of in my head. And I was writing it just for me. I had no intention, unlike my other books, of having this be for public consumption. I just wanted to see what happened if I started to write, combining a bunch of things that had been in my mind. I'd been trying for many years to write a book about the state of masculinity, which I'm calling the melting mood, which is what Shakespeare called crying. And I'd been wrestling with it, and it was just, I was trying to find a voice for it, and I couldn't really find it. And in Barfly, there was this voice that was coming out, which I think you register as being masculine, having bravado, but not wanting to express that in a way that didn't read necessarily as conservative. Because I think a lot of the examples that we're getting of a kind of traditional masculine voice reads as conservative, and I wanted to sort of find a way around that. I wanted it to be wounded, aggressive, not necessarily hostile, not misogynistic, but a sort of sound that I used to hear more. and that I hear in sort of private conversations, but definitely not in contemporary Canadian poetry. And then I sent it to Biblioasis, and Dan, my publisher, I can't believe it. He said, "We love it. Let's do it." And now people are sort of seeing my tinkering, which was supposed to remain private out loud.
Biblioasis has done some pretty amazing books and really is quite a brave publishing house. I'm thinking, for example, of the book that Elaine Dewar did on the lab leak hypothesis.
Oh my God, yes.
Way ahead of...
Oh, but before it was sort of appropriate to really consider.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to masculinity in a moment, but first I want to touch on one of the opening poems named for the nostalgic Scottish song, Auld Lang Syne. There's that theme of alienation there and a mulling over of how lonely and isolating our society has become. The bar shuts down. Nobody is going to the movies or the baseball games. No one's calling you up and coming over for pasta and a dance. There's no plans and people and places to go, no work, no handshakes. And as you write, you disappear into the year. And you also write, "Love was the first to go." It's such a haunting poem. The COVID lockdowns in Toronto were some of the longest in the world. Talk to me about how you see that impacting this poem, this book, our city.
Yeah. My editor sort of joked when I said that Barfly was a COVID book. She was like, "They're all COVID books right now." I think for all of us, it was when it first happened. It just sort of seemed impossible that everything could just vanish, and I was so panicked that things wouldn't come back the way they had been. I realized suddenly I'd taken so much of it for granted. And it was, you know, there were so many competing feelings. I mean, there was the sort of, "Oh, keep calm and carry on about it." There was the panic from the right flank of our politics. There was the terror over our friends and family. There was the sense that this was some sort of, you know, honorable thing to be doing. And all of that was true. I mean, what I just felt was just this like profound longing. I was going through lockdown alone too. So it was just me and my two cats. It felt like the world had sort of sunk to the bottom of the sea, as I think we all remember. And what I hope comes out of Auld Lang Syne is that I suddenly realized how much I really loved the world. I mean, there is a lot of alienation in Barfly, but it's really like it's the being alienated comes from this real sense of love, and to see it vanish so quickly. I mean, the sort of old truism that, you know, the world dies one person at a time, right? You know, and when that person goes, it's like a library burning down. But this was something that no one had ever really seen. It's not like war, where, I mean, say what you will about war, at least you're all together for it. I mean, this was like being sent into a coffin and having to watch the world die, all its rhythms, its monuments, its little pleasures. So the longing that I think is in Barfly comes out of love.
And that really does come through throughout the collection. There is this returning to hope and returning to the sort of small daily pleasures of life, which I think is really, really beautiful. There's also a real rebelliousness to the collection, which I mentioned. And I want to draw attention for our listeners to the poem "Traitorous Former Editors and Cultural Apparatchiks." What is that poem about?
Well, I mean, I wanted to write a book that I wanted to read and that I couldn't really read. And one of the things that occupies the writer's life is the world of writing. And we hear a lot, in contemporary poetry, especially in Canlit, of the importance of community, right? Which always sounds to me like something the recruiter at a cult might say. I mean, I think a writer's job is ultimately solitary, silence interrupted by brief, unpleasant acts of socializing. And you know, one of the things that if you get to be a writer of my age, I'm 40 now, God help me, you are going to run across people who you disliked very, very seriously for intellectual reasons. You know what I mean? Not even personal reasons. And there is, I lived through a lot of churn in the sort of Canlit publishing and journalism world where there would be some absolutely childish behavior, like hysterical childish behavior about the what the overture window of what was acceptable to say was. And you know, when you move over to the journalism side, at least say what you will about the profession, at least people behave in a much more adult fashion. And so I wanted to, without naming names, I wanted the character of Barfly, which is very much like me, but it's kind of like an exaggerated version of me. I wanted to address some of those old assholes who did the wrong thing, thinking they were doing the right thing, and you know, let them know that I still think about them every once in a while.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I do want to talk a little bit about Canlit. There's this line from the collection: "The scary thing about literature is it's dangerously close to talking to yourself." This could also be a statement about our literary culture in this country, which feels right now small and siloed, with diminishing audiences, kind of stifling, conformist. Your friend Jason Gurriel has a great essay about that. I've been disappointed with Canlit and its kind of utter lack of courage, both aesthetically, but also politically. I haven't seen much defense of free expression and viewpoint diversity. I know you've also been a critic of Canlit. How do you think through the point that we are at right now in our literary culture?
Oh, it's such an excellent question. You know, I for a while have been sort of bemoaning certain aspects of it, many of which you mentioned. There's this combination of timidity and rancor, this combination of being like sort of politically siloed in a couple dozen different micro communities while also talking about how important it is that we're all in it together, a terrible combination of, you know, a sort of bunch of like angry, atomized people without much interesting to say, who are also saying we're all in it. We're all in it as a team. A real aversion to idiosyncratic voice. There's like the voices that we, this has been something that's been in Canlit for a long time. This sense in which the person who tends to be most praised is almost like a sloganeer who's an impressionist of people who are already recognizable. You know, we can resemble like a group of mockingbirds at times, like sort of repeating the same, not just the same ideas, but like the same sort of syntaxes over and over. And so part of why I wrote Barfly is because I wanted again to write something that I just had never heard. I'd never heard like a sort of sound like this being made in contemporary Canadian poetry. But it also reminded me of a lot of the, I wanted to remind the reader of poets who had come before, of like sort of sensibilities from hip hop, from popular culture. If you might encounter a voice like this on Twitter even. There's of course like a strain of contemporary Canlit, which is enormously admirable. Some people are doing some of our best work today. I mean, you mentioned Jason Gurriel. My God, the guy's written two books of YA adjacent sci-fi written in heroic couplets. I mean, no one's doing that sort of thing. It's incredible. You know, there are Luke Hathaway is doing some of the most incredible formal work we've ever done. I mean, there are lots and lots of incredible writers across different genres. The issue is, it often takes, and this is a story as old as Canlit, it often takes the Americans or the Brits to appreciate us before Canadians come around to it. I mean, our domestic taste in our own work is really bad, and I think part of that is because our critical culture, our book pages have totally collapsed. There's no, and essentially they collapsed because people ran them out of town. And so the only way one can be recognized now is with one of these silly prizes that are adjudicated by a committee and have their own very specific internal politics. And so it's just like it creates this really bad feedback loop.
And there's also this other issue that I've heard you talk about on a podcast before, which is that there's two conversations going on at all times. There's the conversation that is happening in public, very circumscribed, and the conversation that is happening in private over drinks, over coffee. you know, part of why I left the legacy media was to try to join those two conversations together. I mean, it's so maddening to see one conversation happening, which you know is totally inauthentic. What do we lose when we have these separate tracks of conversation going on in our culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think we lose what's best about us, which is the really good stuff. I mean, I don't know why it is that like the really interesting stuff is the stuff that in the public conversation we're quickest to either admonish or ignore. You know, I think the soul of all writing has to be the truth. Call me old fashioned. You know, whether it's journalism or whether it's literature. I mean, I think the closer a writer is cleaving to something like the truth of sound, you know, the sort of literal truth, the truth of how we really live, what we really think. The measure of an author's importance is their sort of what we used to call authenticity. I think our writers are for the most part being sort of induced to become more and more divorced from that truth. I think there is a whole reward system set up, starting in fine arts programs into post-secondary education, which induces our writers to have as large a gulf as possible between those public and those private conversations. Because the public one is the one that our peers judge us by, that our juries deliberate us by, that our hiring committees decide whether or not to invite us to the faculty or not. That's tough, because then the question I always end up asking is, well, what the hell is the point? Like, why are we doing this? If it's just like a sort of like an escalator for one's career, let's admit it is, you know what I mean? But that's not literature. It can't be the grist. Can't be the grist for one's career outside of the production of literature itself. Then it's like a tool. It's like a cane, you know, it's a piece of machinery. But I'm old fashioned.
Circling back to masculinity before we close, I mean, this is something I've covered on the podcast a lot. We are, to speak in all seriousness now, we are in a crisis of masculinity. I mean, we have declining educational achievement, declining employment, rising suicide, rising addiction. This is a big moment. And yet, as you've already mentioned, the voices that are working to remedy that are of a certain persuasion, and there's not a lot else going on with that conversation. What needs to happen to fill this gap in the conversation?
They obviously need Barfly available at fine bookstores everywhere. I have been thinking about this for a long time. And it really breaks my heart to see what's happening, not just men, as you mentioned, their alienation, their atomization, the rising suicide rates, the failure to achieve, the growing gulf between young men and young women, the whole incel movement, school shootings. I mean, it's horrifying. And almost worse is the examples that they're turning to for a vision of masculinity that they think does heal them. The Andrew Tates, the Jordan Petersons, you know, the Twitter trolls, the YouTube jerks who are giving them sucker. That really scares me. I mean, I think the thing that Barfly tempts with is that, or flirts with, I should say, is it flirts with this vision of masculinity that retains some of the aggrievements, but it always grounds them in a love for the world, a kind of even though there's a lot of sound and complaining and fury in the book, there's I think a kind of stoicism that underlies it. It talks a lot about, you know, inebriation, but there's a kind of sobriety at the heart of it. I think there's despair, but it's also followed really quickly by hope. I wish there was a panacea that I could offer. The only thing I could try and offer was a sound that has been kind of working for me. I mean, I think what men ultimately need is this is the wisdom of you know, my family. I think they need a sense of purpose. I think they need work, you know, and I think they need accountability, and they need women in their lives. You know what I mean? Not just as partners, but as bosses, as friends, as examples, as confidants. You know. Because I don't think either gender can really do it on their own. And retreating to the silo of their own sex isn't going to help, you know? We can't treat each other like enemies. So in other words, I think it's escaping the feedback loop that is giving them that sort of false reassurance, that false hope is a first step to sort of re-engaging with the other side who can't be our enemy, you know?
Well, I think that is a really beautiful place to leave it. And this is a really beautiful book. And thank you for coming on today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for reading Barfly.
Lean Out is hosted and produced by myself, Tara Henley. We are happy to report that we now have listeners in 150 countries and more than 5,000 cities worldwide. If you value our work here, please consider subscribing to my Substack at tarahenley.substack.com. You can also support us by reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts.